The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Now offering 5 years free servicing on every new 142 Hyundai. Ireland's fastest growing car brand. The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Everyone's talking about the revolution driven by Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, sitting across from me is a gentleman who just returned to Ireland last weekend. His name is Gabriel Fitzpatrick. He's from Monaghan, living in Dublin, and he's a doc. And he is an Irish doctor, obviously, but he's also recently working for MSF, and he is just back from Sierra Leone. Gabriel Fitzpatrick, you're very welcome indeed to the programme. As you look back on it, and we'll go into the detail in a different way, what images spring to your mind of your work for the last month?
Good morning. If I look back at it, I would say the images that strike me most during that month I was working in Sierra Leone would be the images of mothers and their children. Because before I left, I understood that a mother's bond with her child is one of the strongest, if not the strongest bonds you will ever come across. But seeing sick mothers and sick children off those mothers was difficult for all the staff out there. So that's the image.
You had to separate them.
We did. Like there are many examples I could give you. Unfortunately, there are many examples I could give you. But when the separating of families, that happened when we would go out into the communities, because a key part of what we're doing out there is we're trying to get the sick people out of the villages into the treatment centres so they can't spread it to their family members. But although that sounds good in theory, what that means in actual practice is that you're going into villages and you're looking for sick people, and those sick people may be mothers, they may be children, they may be 2 or 3 years of age, and you're asking those families to you know, give that person over to MSF so we can take them back to the treatment centre. So you're asking an incredible amount of both the person and their family to put that trust in us to take them to the treatment centre and do the best we can for a virus that has an incredibly high mortality rate. So unfortunately, I've come across many examples while I was out there of having to ask mothers to come with us. And one particular example I can remember, and there are many, was of a young mother in her 30s with a 7 month old child, and her family was surrounding her, and looking at the mother, she didn't look great medically, but then when she stood up, she had bloody watery diarrhea as the child was still clinging to her breast. So and the father was crying, and the grandmother was crying, and the whole family was crying, and the houses are quite close together, and the people in the other houses were crying close by. So eventually, when we convinced the mother that the best thing for her to do was to come with us, the 7 month old child was left there, and who would take care of the 7 month old child, because not all children who are breastfed from infected mothers get the disease.
Do they not?
So no, which is, and we don't know why that is.
Right.
But so it was incredibly difficult. The father wanted to take the child, but he was afraid of getting the disease, and you could see the turmoil taking place inside his head. He didn't know whether to take the child or leave the child. So in the end, it was the grandmother, and lady, she must have been in her 80s. She stepped up and took the child into her care. And, you know, that's risky for her as well, because we don't know what that baby has. We don't know whether that baby is infected or was infected. But luckily, we know now the baby wasn't actually infected.
Right.
But incredibly difficult scenes, separating families and families knowing that the virus is within their family. And there's that turmoil going on. Should we send our loved one away, or should we keep them close by?
Right. You also had an image that you were going through names and somebody that you hadn't dealt with, and you called out a name and this woman came out of a tent towards you.
Yeah, there was. You know, one of the key things in this Ebola outbreak is collecting information, reliable information. And that sometimes means after you admit the patient and you get the medical information, you have to go and ask for more information from them in terms of contacts and so forth. So, you know, you don't want to be doing this to the patient, but you have to in order to save people. So there was this one lady who we needed information from before we went to the village where she was from to carry out an investigation. And so we had to call her out, myself and the interpreter from Sierra Leone. So this lady's, again, she's in her late 20s, and she comes slowly out of the suspected cases tent. And she's got, when people are near the end with Ebola, they get this staggering, rusty, slow walk. And it's difficult to describe unless you see it, but it's a slow, rusty walk. And I could see her coming out of the tent and our heads would hang and we'd know that her chances were extremely low. But as she was coming out, she was like holding the hand of her 3-year-old son. And the killer thing there was that the 3-year-old son also had the slow, rusty walk of somebody at the end of the line with Ebola. And just and watching that mother and her 3-year-old child walk the maybe 10 metres over to us, because we were at the barrier fence. And, you know, the only thing that you noticed there, that you really noticed, was the strength of the grip of the mother with her to her child. And, you know, incredibly difficult images. Yeah. So, but at the end, myself and the interpreter, you know, all we could do was have a mini cry. But being typical men, we had to look away from each other and have a cry to ourselves, because we couldn't do it face to face. But, you know, there's some extraordinarily difficult family scenes taking place out there at the moment.
And just ordinary human and inhuman things happening to people. You have how many tents in your unit? Because 70% are going to die, I understand, it's a current statistic.
At the moment, it stands at 70%. So the people who come in, 7 out of 10 will die. You're seeing variation across different centres, but there's a long explanation into that. We won't go into, but because some people die earlier before they ever get to the centre, so their centres' mortality rates look better than other centres. But yet we have 10 tents in our centres. 8 of them are confirmed, so therefore. Cases that have confirmed Ebola virus in their blood, and the other two are a suspect and a probable tent. And there were people come in initially and we try to figure out if they have Ebola or if they don't have Ebola, and if they do, they go confirmed cases. If they don't, they're discharged home. Right.
And they sleep in single beds within our cots within the tent. And what happens when they die? I mean, I'm thinking of the people that are alive. I'm sorry, I know one should have the respect for the dead, and of course there would be. But how is that handled?
Yeah, well, I've dealt with that as well. As you've mentioned, 70% die. So, you know, if you're in a... If a patient is in a ward, a confirmed cases ward, 7 out of 10 people in that ward are going to die. So they are going to see those people dying around them. And that is an extremely traumatic situation for those patients to see. Not to be too graphic about it, but when somebody dies, you go into the tent and you try to screen off the area, but sometimes you don't have the screens, sometimes it's difficult to find screens. But what it means is, you know, the person has to be, their clothes have to be taken off, they have to be sprayed in 0.5% chlorine from a backpack sprayer, then they have to be placed in a white plastic bag which is sealed. Then that bag has to be sprayed again with 0.5% chlorine. Then they're put in another white bag, and then we carry them out of the tent to the back of the treatment centre, where there's a truck waiting for that body and all the other bodies from that day. So we try to not let the patients see that happening, but in reality, that's difficult to actually make happen. So there are patients that are seeing people that they were talking to just a day or so ago being wrapped up in double plastic bags, soaked
and
in chlorine.
Smell of chlorine.
And being brought out to the morgue waiting for the pickup truck.
And then
truck.
Where do they go?
Well, they go, there's an agreement with the Ministry of Health that in Sierra Leone that they take the body from us when we have it prepared and in an appropriate way. They take the body and they bring it to a plot that has been already set aside for Ebola right. patients who have right. unfortunately died. But the families of those patients are also given an opportunity to be there at the time when
that's
the
a critical
dies.
Time in terms of danger, isn't it?
It is. So, because the you know,
because it's infectious, the body becomes more infectious.
Absolutely,
yeah.
And that's why obviously bodies need to be double bagged, and that's what Ebola loves, this virus, because I've seen it from either being in the treatment centre or being out in the community, that when people are at their weakest and they're at their neediest in terms of support, what's a family member going to do when they're in the village with no medical support? They're going to go over and help that person, that help their mother, help their father, help their brother or sister. So that's what Ebola loves. Ebola loves family members coming over and wiping the vomit away from a family member's face, cleaning up the diarrhea. But it's that vomit and it's that diarrhea that's teeming with Ebola virus, and that's why we're seeing it's close family members who are getting infected with this virus.
Yeah, I saw you quoted as saying that affection is what Ebola thrives on, affection and kindness. And I think it's important to say that it's not just all white Western people that are working here. But you have lost members of staff.
We have, and that's something like I try to say every time I'm talking about what MSF is doing. This is not a group of Europeans and North Americans flying in to save the day in West Africa, because 90% of the staff that are dealing with this situation at the moment are from Sierra Leone. They are doing the backbreaking work of running these Ebola treatment centres. They make up the team. We are just coming in as support, but it's local people from Sierra Leone stepping into danger's way to help out, you know, their fellow country men and women in these difficult situations.
Now,
I
you
describe.
Have a wife and you have a 7-month-old child. What has you doing these dangerous things?
I do have I'm lucky enough, I have to say, to be married to an extremely kind and intelligent lady, and I have a 7-month-old son. But we were one of the things, you know, when we see what's happening in West Africa, when we see the images on the TV, I work as a public health doctor here in Ireland. So one of the things I specialise in is outbreak control. Mm. I've worked with MSF before in outbreak controls, and when you combine all those things together, and most importantly, having an extremely understanding wife and caring wife, that gives you the opportunity to go out and help. But it's easy, you know, it's as difficult for the people, your family members you leave behind, as it is for the person going out. Mm. Because your family members, you know, they're at home and they don't know what's happening on a day-to-day basis. You know, when they go to bed at night, they're not sure where
because
you are.
Because you have lost colleagues.
We have, unfortunately. One of the nurses I worked with, a great guy, family man, he unfortunately got the virus and died. And and he was an MSF worker from Sierra Leone. And we've had 10 of our workers in MSF have now contracted the virus, and unfortunately 4 of them have died. So it just shows that, you know, this is not a zero risk situation we're in. And when healthcare workers are working in this environment, you know, there's a certain element of risk there that we can't negate totally. But we try our best.
Yeah, you operate covered in plastic.
So only when you're dealing in the high risk zone, in the hospital, having direct contact with patients, or if you're in the community, in a person's house, examining a person in that house. But in general, if you're talking to a person with Ebola and you stay 3 metres away from them, you do not need to be in the full body plastic suit. I've talked to hundreds of patients with Ebola 3 metres away from me, and I haven't been wearing the full body plastic suit, and I haven't got Ebola. And I won't, because I'm outside the 21 days as well since being in the last high risk zone. So I definitely don't have it.
But you're not allowed to shake hands with people.
Oh, absolutely.
You're not allowed to have contact with people, which is completely opposite to what you'd expect from somebody of a caring profession.
It's so difficult. You know, and sometimes when you meet up, I have to say I've slipped up and I've shaken somebody's hands, and immediately you recoil going,
oh,
I shouldn't do
God,
that at all.
Yeah.
So you're not allowed to stay. So it's we hear this thing about PPD and PPE, but what it is, it's personal protective distance. Keep 3 metres away, 2 to 3 metres away from people, and that will keep you safe from Ebola because it's not airborne.
What is Ebola?
Well, basically, we don't... Obviously, because it's raging across West Africa at the moment, we don't know much about it. That's plain to see for everybody because we don't have a cure for it. But it's a very small virus, infects people through bodily fluids. When you touch somebody who has bodily fluids with the virus in it and you touch your face, your eyes, your mouth, you have a high chance of getting it. What it will cause will... It basically causes many organs within your body to fail and you die of dehydration. But the details of how the virus kills you, we don't understand like we understand HIV or other viruses like that. Yeah, that took a while.
Yeah,
exactly.
And tens of millions.
Absolutely.
Died.
So we don't understand the full picture of Ebola at all.
There was a very nice man in with us a while ago, and he was on his way out actually. His name is John Mitchell. He was involved with John of God's, and he made the point, you know, that there's a possibility that we might be getting hysterical about this, like the people dying of malaria in gazillions.
Absolutely. The other key point I think is being missed here is that if we look at the figures for Ebola, over 5,000 infected, almost 3,000 dead. But when you're working out there, you can see there's no healthcare workers in the hospitals. You know, there's nobody treating malaria. There's nobody treating pneumonia. The numbers are dramatically reduced. But the basic medical care of treating basic medical conditions is now not happening. So you're going to see multiples of the numbers of people who have died from Ebola die from simple things that we know how to treat and that we know save lives.
Mm.
And that's an extreme. That is a story that's not being told at the moment. But, you know, if you work in a community hospital in eastern Sierra Leone and you see somebody come in with fever and you don't have a malaria test kit, you don't know whether that is malaria or whether that's Ebola. And you know, we can say it's most likely a malaria. It's easy for us to say that here. But if you're the healthcare worker there,
yeah,
and you've seen your colleagues die from Ebola, you're going to be scared and you're going to be turning away patients from your local health clinic. So that is a major issue at the moment. The depletion of staff within the normal healthcare system.
And that happened with AIDS as well. And people were calling it TB and whatever. That was to do with stigma as much as anything else. But the 3 out of 10 that survive, they get a certificate.
They do. I think a lot of workers, you know, any type of worker there would be having a breakdown a lot quicker if they weren't seeing some people get out alive. And 3 out of 10 in the unit I was working in were. And it's an amazing thing to see. You know, we have this gate. There's this gate in the front of the treatment tents, and it's for people who walk out when they're cured. And you've got, and because, you know, Africans have style, Africans can dance, and when a person from Sierra Leone survives Ebola, they dance out that gate. But the really remarkable thing is watching the people around, because the people in the tents watching this person leave, they know most most likely they won't leave. But they're so happy for that person to be leaving. You see no jealousy in their eyes.
Really?
I haven't seen that before anywhere. To see, you know, these people, the people in the tents, know they most likely won't get out, but they're so happy for the people who do. And that, you know, that injects hope through the whole, you know, treatment centre there. All of a sudden you'll see all the staff, whether they're from Sierra Leone, whether they're from Uganda, whether they're from Japan, you'll see all the staff get that jilt they need to continue on with the work they're doing. And it's, you know, it's a remarkable thing to see, because you need it, basically.
And your MSF rules are 1 month is the tour of duty. Tough month.
It's easy. Well, it's a tough month, but it's a lot tougher on those workers, the workers of Sierra Leone, the healthcare workers of Sierra Leone, who make up 90% of our staff. You know, they're working there all the time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's a lot. You know, you might see the people from abroad coming in. They stay a month and, you know, it's extremely tough month. But, you know, the workers out there, you know, they're there all the time, and the patients are there all the time, and they're the people we need to be thinking about.
I know that, yeah, but I'm sure it is very stressful nonetheless.
Extremely stressful.
Yeah, I would have thought so. I gathered that they've locked down Freetown now, which is in the west of the country, but the treatment centres are in the east of the country, so that even with locking down and finding people, they've nowhere to take them.
I was there when the last quarantine took place in Sierra Leone, and we don't know a lot about Ebola, but what we can say is these type of quarantines won't solve the problem with the Ebola outbreak in West Africa at the moment. The vaccines and the hyperimmune serum and the novel treatments, they may solve the problem months down the line. It will be months before they get into the field. What we do know solves the problem, what helps
hydration.
And controls it, but at a broader level for controlling the outbreak, is finding the cases in the community, bringing them to the treatment centres and following up the contacts for 21 days. But you need massive infrastructure to do that across the region. That's not happening at the moment, and we need that now to save lives, to save people from getting the infection and infecting others.
Okay, listen, it's very interesting, it's very scary, and it's very depressing. You sometimes think that the continent of Africa is kind of, it's not fair, but anyway, there are, I know, other good news stories within Africa at the moment. But anyway, Gabriel Fitzpatrick, good to see you home and healthy, I suspect was what your wife and Oisin thought when they saw you. Okay.
Thank you very much indeed.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Everyone's talking about the revolution driven by Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.